This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we read a story from the November 1986 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is The Place of Turnings by Russell Griffin. Mine is a world of mazes, oh, small and humble, I admit, but consider the view from the portico outside. I cannot see it, but I remember from the late king my father's time, tiled roofs blinding in the sunlight, spiraling tier on tier up the sides of the crater almost to the grassy rim. From your ship this morning, you must have seen those roofs in patterned whorls, more intricate than the place of turnings, because they are unplanned, weaving in and out and around and down, until, as you swooped closer, they dissolved into confusion. Nod, if it is not so. Please, you know I cannot look in any direction more than a moment. Yes. Thank you. I thought as much. The closer one gets to anything, the more incomprehensible it becomes. And mine is a world as well of the most exquisite introspection. Consider, please, the poor man whose fondest possession, a flowering Uriel, inadvertently shades some shoots of blue Perseus in his wealthy neighbor's garden, so they wither and die. The neighbor, of course, is too polite to mention it. The man's conscience drives him to apologize, but at his neighbor's gate, he wonders if he may be apologizing, not because he regrets the loss of such exquisite beauty, but because he hopes to profit from his rich neighbor's good opinion. Of course, that good opinion might save him from starvation, but he does not wish to believe his motivation so crass. So, to avoid the appearance of crassness, he must give the appearance of insensitivity. When his neighbor comes to the gate, he turns on his heel and goes home. Please do not be impatient. I am coming to the point. Of course, we appreciate how far you've come and how you have cared for us like your children. Of course, we all remember how obedient and quick to please was the late king, my father, who was blessed in finding favor with those who came before you. And yes, they too pointed out how many great ships your father of fathers could send to circle our poor world, though perhaps another time we might discuss how you need so many to rule there, whereas here I alone am sufficient. Tatagi, more wine for our guests. No, 1,000 pardons, good fellow, the other Kilkerin now, and another dram of Tortone for me. I grow restless. And if I may be allowed the liberty, your colleagues were just this impatient with the intricacies of polite discourse. Forgive me. Too often I forget you were not trained to patience from childhood as I was. Each prince here must learn to live hedged in by ceremonious etiquette. A small price to preserve the delicate equipoise of the galaxy, don't you agree? Your father of fathers would, I'm sure. The Tortone helps, of course. Oh, yes, they were here. Your colleagues, I mean. My humblest apologies, that was not made clear before. I remember them quite well, 4 altogether. An exobiologist, a taxonomist, an eco-engineer, and a stratigrapher. They sat where you are, facing the murals of the outer wall. Lovely, are they not? Crichia, the great dark and father of all, politely refusing his son's pleadings, who must later slay him and rise to the sun to shed the light of creation's first morning, painted in the late king, my father's time. And I studied the angles of their spines and the set of their shoulders in the dimness, as I have learned to do, for in the eyes we live the power. We go him all over, their leader said in his thin voice. Cromlech was his name, the taxonomist, a delightful man, of course, but dare I say, perhaps the least bit too particular. His head was cropped so close I could discern the delicate suffusions of blood across the back of his neck and lower skull that accompanied each wave of emotion. Me numpa one collector, make him lissy, count him numpa alla kind, big fella, small fella, beastie you got. A census of our animal species, I said. How useful, as long as custom is observed. So we've been doing aerial mapping and trace grams. Got a machine go looky looky in big fella jungle garden next crater. I could hear the sharp breaths from the servants, but I held up my hand. To criticize a guest is, well, one of four levels between incivility and solecism for which you have no adequate equivalents. You've been mapping the place of turnings? I asked. You keep in beastie, no can find anywhere else. The real house rare. Since time immemorial, we have cultivated in the place of turnings all creatures that preceded us by hedging them in with cultivation, I explained. Long ago, we learned that balance is the supreme law of the universe. You have a metaphor for it, I am told. The bell-shaped curve. Such a colorful and evocative phrase, for bells are exquisite in shape as well as sound, are they not? The more civilized we become at one end, the more we must preserve the counterweight of wild and savage things on the other. The king's beasts, they are called, because by tradition only the king may enter there. But the trace grams, look-see, tell 'em, us one beastie in big fella trouble. His voice became tense and anxious. Got him no godfella man, no godfella marry. My throat constricted. A creature with no mate? I risked the back of his head for a moment, then glanced towards Tatagi. Alive? As of this morning, big fella King Hazleton here ran the traces from orbit before we shuttled down. Taboo there, yes? So no can be him one of your people, 'cause them no can get in. Do you have any idea what species of creature? What kind him be? Cromlech glanced at the others. Shaped like one of us, I persisted. I could see the muscles at the back of his head knot as he clenched his jaw and hunched further forward. Possibly to the untrained eye, said his number two, the exobiologist Hazleton. We haven't actually seen it ourselves. My fingers trembled as I closed them around the dram Tatagi held out to me, fearing for creation until the torone had burned its sweet way down and begun to spread its numbness. You were right, old friend, I whispered sadly to him. Anyway, Cromlech continued, him only one that kind beastie alive. Gotta get him look-sees. With his hands, he pantomimed the square shape of the mechanical image records they were forever making with their devices. enter the place of turnings yourselves? This number one scientific emergency, Kromlich said, almost turning to face me. Got to get him solid proof, chop chop, before they die him, or might as well never exist him at all. That science, you got him some god we can make sacrifice to? One cannot weigh off decorum. I looked at the evils, but I knew what I had to do. There is a way, I said at last. You mustn't, Majesty, whispered Tatagi. I know it's he. I know he's survived. The burden would be mine, even if the fault were not. You warned me it had to be done by the letter of decorum, or it would come to nothing. I turned to Kromlich. The uninitiated may enter the place of turnings at the hem of the king. Kromlich seemed unhappy, as though he feared I might interfere. Me hear him it taboo for King Fella going outside King Fella house. After dark, when the palace twilight has spread out over the world, the king may venture from his throne, I said, but only into the place of turnings, where creation's lines of force are so weak and disordered they can be disturbed without fear. There I will lead you to... I could not speak the word that was him. I dismissed them all and ordered more Tyrone. Then I waited until the sun should set. At last, Tatagi brought my palanquin, and my blind hoodsman lifted me in, lest my feet touch the ground. A moment later, Tatagi's withered hand parted a side curtain. A thousand pardons, he whispered. I beg permission to share the danger with you, Lord. You, of all people, violate decorum, I said. I am an old man who should have advised you better. My usefulness is over. I could not bear to lose you, I said. Only a fool would exchange the good services you still have in you for help this one night. Stay. I weep for you, he sighed, but in pride as well as sorrow. One hand thrust in the fat coil of ribbon, the other the gift of kings. I stared at it, resolution dwindling. Only the ribbon, I pleaded. Would you stumble from the path again? He asked. The old ways are still the best, no matter what he told you, and kinder, if indeed he lives. Whose advice would I trust more? It is old Tatagi who brought me into this world. It is he who cuts my hair and nails while I sleep, so they may be considered stolen, to spare me desecrating my own holy excrescences. I accepted the gift into my sleeve bag, its coldness sharp against my skin. Then I gave the command to go. With infinite care not to jostle creation, my bearers raised the palanquin and carried me through the great hall to the outside, where your colleagues waited, weighed down with heavy packs and strange equipage. At once I was struck by smells I had not known for so long, pungent aromas I'd taken for granted in my princehood. I was tempted to halt and savor them, but decorum drove me on. It okie dokie take him some specimen in place of turnings? Kromlich's voice asked casually from outside the curtain. You know, a sample King Fella beastie? Luckily, the Tyrone was still strong. As you will, I said, and my voice seemed calm. You are guests. We moved on to the creaks of the palanquin springing ever so lightly on the poles as we began to climb the streets of this crater slope. Why taboo for King Goim outdoors in daytime? Cromlech began. The king's throne is the center of a web of power, and the king's every move, like the shiver of a spider's footfall, is felt along each line of force to the farthest anchor point. We got 'em spider kind thing in our world, he observed. 40,000 Aranomorphae and counting Mygalomorpha. He hesitated, embarrassed. Lots of numpa spider. My every act has a consequence, I continued. If I wear knots in my clothing, a mother in travail may be unable to deliver because her birth canal is constricted. So you take him, how say, sedative to keep him still? He said. The torone, yes, I said. But how come world no dyin' same time big fella king your father dyin'? I fancied a smile of condescension in his voice. It would have, I answered, if it weren't for decorum. 1,000 pardons, Tatagi. Honored guests, propriety requires I let my retainers retire. The hour is late. Would any of you like more wine before they go? Fill their glasses anyway, Tatagi, and another dram for me, and then good night, old friend. Where was I? Oh, yes, I told Cromlech how in ancient days, when a king's health began to fail, his heir had to enter the palace and... But it is death to know the ending of a king. Suffice to say, when his earth time comes, his life power must pass directly to his successor before it can break from his clouding eyes and wreak havoc across creation. My father sought what he conceived to be alternatives kinder and better suited to these times of change since your people came. And so once, I fear, did I. Even this makes you shift with discomfort? I understand. One must be born to our convictions. Yet that night I was still insecure enough to need to convince unbelievers. I cracked the curtain at the front to look over the shoulders of my bearers and the rooftops beyond into the sky itself. Look, just above the horns of the tallest Uriel on the rim, I said to Cromlech, freeing my thoughts to focus through the line of force from my eyes to that point. Out they shot through the clinging clouds, the thinning air, and were gone. Nothing. I bit my lip. For the barest moment, I began to fear that the late king, my father, had been right. But I tried again, squeezing my eyelids shut. Again, nothing. Then, when I was about to disdain, a flash, a hair to one side of where I thought I had struck, but what of that, followed by a downward arcing eyelash of light. I know it seems miraculous to you, but a king never lies, and his sight is always clear. I had expected Cromlech, who actually witnessed my puissance, to say something, but I had to prompt him. That shooting star, he said, what about it? My eyes shook it from the firmament. Planet Goem through meteor shower now, same time every year, he said. Science tell him that. Look him, Numpa 2 there. You do him that too? By chance, a second star was arcing down. What can I say? Logic cannot make the blind man see. I shrugged and leaned back, feeling the angle of ascent lessening, and suddenly my curtain rings rattled as my hoodsmen tightened them lest at the crest I should inadvertently gaze upon the sea and boil it away, never to look upon the ocean. Sometimes that seems the heaviest burden of all. How I remember my nurse taking me down to the shore, the damp press of the breeze, the incoming shove and departing tug of each wave, the treacherous sand running out from beneath my feet. How I would lie in the hissing beach grass and watch the hard, flat sea feather into the black storm clouds as they came dipping down, driving the screeching seabirds before them. I could not appreciate then why, when nurse brought me home, the king, my father, would sit me where you are to tell him how the stormy water would whap and when, and the seafowl wheel. Ah, the pity I might have felt had I but understood. But on balance, perhaps, I was blessed in then being equally ignorant of his error in faulting decorum, and of the even graver errors he would fall into. Then the palanquin dipped forward as we descended into the next crater. I often wonder whether the place of turnings grew naturally out of the ruins of Critiaea's palace, or was planned from its first seedling. It is too long ago to know. Being too far away can make a thing as incomprehensible as being too close. Now we could hear the distant growls and mournful wails of the king's beasts, and the ears of one who knew might also pick out the metallic chinks of the gardeners at work. Cromlech grew more uneasy. "Where him big fella gate?" "I am looking for it," I said. "You forget him where him be?" "It is never in the same place twice." The gardeners had seen us now. I caught glimpses of them as they dropped to their knees, facing away, and I held my hand up in unseen blessing. "Every night, while the equipoise is locked," I continued, "these gardeners replant the outer layers." "Why?" "To keep the king's beasts from finding their way out." "Why not put 'em bars on gate?" "But decorum requires them to be free, to come and go," I said. "If because of its windings, the place of turnings confines the king's beasts to its heart, then it is chance that imprisons them, not we." "Then big fella king only real prisoner?" he said. I did not answer, concentrating instead on how punky the air felt before my thoughts 1,000 paces ahead. Perhaps there was some kind of interference, or perhaps I had not yet had the practice of my predecessors. But at last I had to grant a gardener the privilege of leading us, and in a few moments his heart was gladdened to show my bearers where to set the palanquin gently down. My hoodsman pulled back the hedge-side curtains. With the briefest glance, I caught the mass of thick gray leaves lapping one over the other like armor scales amongst dense constellations of new leaflets. A little beyond was a low arch grown about with freshly planted bush and bramble, little more than a puncture in the leafy wall, a peephole hardly big enough for a man to pass through. I shivered. "That's the entrance?" Cromlech asked incredulously. "It exists for the king's need," I answered, "not to ease the way of others." I swung my legs out the open side and slipped my toes among the wet and rubbery leaves to touch just inside the opening. Then I thrust myself away with both hands. My knees nearly buckled with the unaccustomed weight, but I steadied myself by grabbing a branch overhead and straightened my trembling legs. I was standing. Do not think I fault tradition, too, but I cannot deny it was a sensation so long forgotten it seemed new, like being born again. For however short a time, I was free as any of my subjects. I took one stiff step, the ground deliciously springy beneath my sole, then a second, but I mastered the temptation to forget why I had come. I tied one end of the ribbon to a thick leaf stem, shaking cold dew down from the interface of branches overhead. It soaked my shoulders. Then I felt something watching from the emptiness behind the leaves. I turned, but at that instant, Kromlech came crashing through behind the pole of light from his helmet, bent double under a pack bristling with lashes of tubes, and the something flitted back into the darkness. Kromlech was startled. I hadn't turned away. In this chaos, the decorum is lifted, I explained. But please, no light. You will frighten my beasts. He muttered angrily and turned off his helmet. I stared into the column of darkness. It was necessary to remember that in the place of turnings, the true way would never be the obvious one. Just visible, halfway down, yawned the mouth of a branching gallery. Kromlech asked Hazelton if she could get a reading for them to follow, but she shook her head, her face lit a strange green by the device she peered into. "Why not just follow the king?" I heard the stratigrapher Morano say. "He knows the place." He carried a long, thin cylinder that I took to be some kind of projectile weapon. I consented to lead the way, playing out the ribbon through the stripes and flecks of moonlight that filtered among the generations of branches. With each stride, my footsteps grew more confident, yet the something I'd sensed was still pacing us on the other side of the hedge. Was it he? Some say that Kritia, first king and father of all, still lurks at the heart, I said, to hide the shame of his plot against his child, the sun. At the first branching, I paused. My senses were still muffled, my thoughts unsure. Could it be I was unworthy and lacked the gifts of my forebears? Had my father's betrayal of tradition damned me as well? I peered uncertainly down into the dark throat. Did an unseen dead wall lurk there? I continued straight. From farther inside echoed a low growl, then an answer further off. At the far turning, I led them back along the crackling gravel of a double back. "Won't this take us back where we came in?" Kromlech asked. "Sometimes the opposite direction is the shortest way," I answered. Kromlech hesitated. "Klimowitz, go back to that last branch, just in case," he said. "If it dead ends, turn around and catch up, and stay in radio contact." I watched him disappear, obediently, back up the black tunnel. Even if I had been free to stop him, it would have been the worst impoliteness to intervene. "Do you feel it?" Morano said as we drove on deeper and deeper, like something watching. "Don't you start falling into local mumbo-jumbo," Kromlech said. "Yes," I said. "It is only your fancy." "Say, look at this," Hazelton said, pointing at a purple kingsbane bulb above some shoots of Perseus struggling to survive in the scant sun. "Oh, we've never seen anything like that, I'm sure," Kromlech said. taking his eye from his image recorder to reach for it. "It grows only here," I said. "Don't touch it." He snatched his fingers back just in time. "You said we could collect specimens." I picked a pebble from the path and tossed it over the flower head. The bulb darted up in a sunburst of purple petals that slapped shut around the rock. "It prefers flesh," I said, "but it isn't particular. That is why so few who enter here return." I thought with sadness of my only other journey here. There was a roar. It seemed closer, but one of the tricks of the place of turnings is that one can never be sure whether a sound comes from the next gallery over or from miles away. "Klimowitz," Murano shouted into his communication device. "You there?" The only answer was an empty hiss, like the surf that used to pound the beach. "Must be a temporary dead spot," Kromlich said. "Klimowitz is miles away. He's fine. He's doing his job, and we'd better do the same." We moved on, another turning, and another. "Do you hear a kind of buzzing?" Hazelton asked. "Sounds like those mock bees on the last island." She ducked as the passage constricted into a low-ceilinged narthex. "Did we get specimens of them?" Kromlich wanted to know. We emerged into a kind of nave. There, unexpectedly, loomed the mossy cistern just as I remembered it, a great basin hewn into living boulders thrusting between the leaves, a last vestige of Krititia's palace. Above it, the small birds hovered and darted like bright jewels to deposit their distillate, their shadows flickering among the starry reflections of its still surface. Beyond lay the sunken and putrid carcasses of several of the smaller beasts. Of all the place of turning's creatures, the small birds alone could leave and return, I said, for they fly straight through the gaps between the leaves, but they remain here because nowhere else can they find the king's bane. A stone pipe drops off their store, drop by drop, into a new cistern outside the place of turnings. "So you use the honey to ferment some kind of intoxicant?" Hazelton asked. "Not precisely," I said. "Wait a minute. Is this what your torone comes from?" "Look how much there is," Murano marveled, "and they told us it was so rare." "You know who they are, how?" Kromlich said softly, thinking I could not hear. "You can't trust a thing they say." "It takes many years to yield one measure of torone," I said. "Once a princeling chased a bright crater bird in here. He came upon this vat and climbed up on the rim to see what smelled so enticing, but he grew so entranced that he lost his footing and fell in. He was paralyzed instantly, of course. He drowned in the unspeakable sweetness." At that moment, the leaves shook with a roar of rage and pain. It came from too huge a beast to be he, yet I was sure he was near. I halted. At the far bend of the next gallery, a small head poked suddenly into a shaft of moonlight to sniff at us. "What a cute little thing," Murano said, halting. The black mass of the rest of its body swayed into view behind it, exhaling the stench of rotted leaf and ancient flesh. "Do we have one of those?" Kromlich gasped, raising his imager. I could see the tattered outline of its transparent double wings. A marlot. It seemed to favor one side as though it were injured, and it roared with pain. "Whatever it is, it's not what we're after," Kromlich whispered, stepping back. Hazelton began to back towards us, too. It stood silent and still as stone, head extended to study us. Then Cromlech's device burred softly as he recorded the Marlot's image. At once, its head jerked back. The recorder hummed on. With an agonized croak, the Marlot flung its ponderous body towards us in a clatter of armor plates and crackle of branches. Hazelton was too late, breaking into a run. The coarse hairs of the Marlot's spiky forelegs caught her clothing, and she disappeared beneath the creature. "She's got the directional equipment!" Cromlech screamed over his shoulder. My powers were still no stronger or more collected, but I knew what the king, my father, would have done. I remembered the day he turned me to face him. "Forget these silly superstitions," his voice said, as I kept my eyes shut to preserve decorum. "It's not magic a true king needs, even if there were such a thing. Will you look at me, for mercy's sake? It is courage." He was wrong about tradition, but he was a brave man, no mistake. So I stood firm and faced the oncoming creature. Against my determination, it stopped, as though it had been struck by a spear. It hesitated in confusion, like a wave gone too far up the beach, its lower skirts of armor swaying. Then it groaned, sagged against the hedge, and sank down onto its side as though the air had been sucked out of it. We all heard Hazelton's weak cry as its weight settled on her. "Quick!" Morano cried. "She'll be crushed!" I squeezed forward as far as I could. Between the hedge and the body, I could just see the stiffened finger of her hand reaching out, wet with blood and gritty with dirt. Just beyond, the lights of her device winked from where it had been pressed against the leaves. I drew it into my sleeve bag without being noticed. "Too late," I said. Morano wanted to pull the body free, but Cromlech ordered him to help look for her device. When they couldn't find it, they climbed up along the creature's side, streaked with mud and furred with patches of lichen, to measure and record. "You see, it could not harm the king," I said. "Bull," Morano answered, pointing. "Something tore its belly open." I saw the yellow ichor he pointed to, oozing from three deep wounds along its underside. One was fresh. His work, of course. There was no mistaking that. "Our readings never indicated anything big enough to do this," Cromlech said. "But it could be smart enough," Morano said, "if we've really got the first ever independent evolutionary curve here, and not the descendants of some lost expedition, then this possible missing link." A scream broke from the other side of the hedge. "Klimowitz?" Morano shouted. "Klimowitz!" He began to back at the hedge with the whirling blades of some mechanized cutting device, but the iron branches shook without breaking. "No, it's this way," Cromlech cried. "Over there! If we just hadn't lost Hazelton's equipment." The scream was cut off. The two remaining scientists exchanged mute looks. Morano snapped off the wine of his cutting instrument and exchanged it for the weapon slung from his shoulder. "I'm loading triples." "How are we going to make scientific history if you atomize it?" Cromlech said. "Digital imaging is all well and good, but we've got to have at least the hide." I led them up over the mass of flesh choking our way, then down to the next branching and to what appeared to be a cul-de-sac, but I pressed on doggedly to where the dead end proved itself a fool's wall holding the next gallery. Had I sensed it? had my powers finally begun to develop? Waves of cold seemed to wash over me. Was he near? I felt the gift hard against my forearm. He's gone into some kind of trance, Morano said. My heart labored in my chest as I tried to drill into the darkness with my thoughts, but the blackness was a dead band across the emptiness of my eyes. I stumbled forward. Wait here, I managed, grabbing from branch to branch to steady myself down the length of the gallery. I felt the light before I could see it beyond the corner. It seemed to coalesce out of the dark, like the glow a jar of stars might cast if they could be plucked like small birds from the sky. All at once, the passage opened into a nave filled with moonlight. He was crouched behind a bush, red eyes glittering through the leaves. He rose as I came forward, head monstrously, unrecognizably swollen, scraps of brown leaf and tendril clinging to his shaggy mane. Did you bring any? He rasped, trying to clear the catch in his throat, as though the months of silence had made his phlegm as thick with twigs and bark as his mane. Or did you just come back to finish the job? Don't blame me, I said. Blame you! The laugh echoed along the shoots of starlight between the leaves. For wanting your own father dead? He rose, bent back warily as an animal's. In one hand he held a crude spear, its tip dark and wet. I could never wish that, I said. Was it out of love you and Tatagi drugged me and left me here to die? Each word stumbled on the heels of the last like soldiers too close together. It's the heir's duty when the king fails in body or in mind, but my hand rebelled and I hoped this place would do what I couldn't. I loved you. You lie! But you were trying to change everything. I was taking advantage of what the off-worlders had to offer, the things they could teach us. You were imperiling creation. Is that what the old ingrate told you? Tatagi's heart ached at what he had to do. He laughed again, then wiped a thread of drool from the corner of his mouth with his forearm. He'll destroy you. He'll lead you to strike out at these people, and they have powers to make even your imaginary ones look puny. They can annihilate this whole planet. Never. The old ways have always been our salvation. Why else would I willingly make myself a prisoner? That's the joke, isn't it? The crown you murdered for turns out to be a golden fetter. He began pacing restlessly, tugging at his matted fur with his nails. No matter anymore. It's too late. It's too late. Did you bring any or not? Any what? As if you didn't know after all these, what is it, weeks, months, years on my throne, I've lost count. He shivered. Tyrone, of course. You're no longer king. You die. Don't be a fool. It's poison, only if you haven't built up a tolerance. Why do you think old Tatagi laced our meals with it from birth? To make us the living statues decorum needs on the throne. But eventually, we can't live without it. Refuse your next dram and try to sleep. Try even to sit for an hour. That will teach you agony. Refuse it for a month, and your body will twist and swell into what mine has become. He pawed the earth with his foot,
just a measure a day. That's all I need. I'm no threat. My thoughts get more jumbled every day. You can fight the off-worlders all you want. I wouldn't even try to find the way out.
He sank to his knees. Please. You'd risk all creation?
You still dealing in Tatagi's tripe? I suppose you think that Krikia still lives in here too. That you can't look at anything or think about it too long without burning it up.
He shook his massive head.
Haven't you tried it just once and found it doesn't work? We're powerless as babies, both of us. It's what every king learned in time and kept to himself until me. Creation doesn't so much as twitch whether we stub a toe or die by a son's hand. The Toron just makes the discovery easier to bear.
I stopped a Marlot with my thoughts tonight.
No, boy. I struck it through the hedge with my spear to save your life.
I stifled a cry, eyes burning with tears, as I tore the gift from my sleeve. I saw him shield his red-rimmed eyes as it flashed down through the moonlight, but at the last moment it froze. I couldn't do it, not even to preserve creation from the off-worlders, not my own father. There was a sharp crack. He jerked, stumbled back, then sank to his knees before me, his mane glittering with blood. From the corner of my eye, I saw Marano lower his weapon. A puff of smoke hung where the barrel had been.
We were right, Marano said. It's humanoid. Would it have been so hard to share?
The creature struggled to hold up his shaggy head and look at me. You don't understand. It's an heir's kindest gift. When the king's reason and judgment fail, I said softly, I want the same quick death when my earth time comes.
So you say now, he laughed. Go ahead, but finish it the old way or I'll come for you. I can't help myself. I'll search day and night. It's not the off-worlders or revenge. It's the drug, and if the path to the gate eludes me, I still know where the cistern is. I'll crack it open, let it all run out, then see what it is to be a beast.
This time, when the gift rose and fell, the bright blade did not hesitate. There was the faintest look of relief on his face, as he rocked back on his heels, then swayed and toppled to the gravel in the hedge path. In an instant, I'd turned him over, digging with my knife and fingers.
Your own father?
It was Marano. A king has no father, I said. This was only another of the king's beast. I looked down at the wet lumps glistening in my palm like two sticky, round fruits.
Don't let him damage it,
Kromlich shouted as he shuffled up to us. He seemed to be assembling some kind of weapon from his pack.
We've got to have it for...
Relax. It's an isolated mutation, maybe a local cancer, but it's got nothing to do with evolution here, Marano said. Matter of fact, it turns out it's this guy's... Quickly, I brought my hand to my lips.
For Christ's sake, he's eating them, Marano cried. He's eating the goddamned eyes.
Shh, Kromlich said. Don't get him worked up or he might hurt the rest. Gently, he squeezed the lever at one end of his weapon, and the nozzle at the other vomited a column of foam. this hold 'em, big fella beastie, till we get to refrigerator and ship," he said soothingly. "Keep meat good in case king fella want him more later. Sure, you eat 'em both, big fella, look, see?" With a gurgle, the nozzle spewed billows of undulating foam into the rattled starlight. It settled like waves spume over the king, my father, filling the eye sockets. Morano turned away, speechless. I had no expression. My job was done. "If you want 'em all a meat," Cromlech said, "okie dokie, then we just take 'em bones when you done eating. Stuff 'em skin instead." I stared down at the gift, blade still wet. I licked it clean and slipped it away for the rest of our line. "You've just got to know how to handle them, that's all," Cromlech said to Morano. "You don't understand," Morano said. "No, you've got to let them have their little treats, and if you're patient, you get what you want." I stepped back and took in a turn of ribbon, and another. When I was far enough into the shadows, I ran. "Where'd he go?" Cromlech cried as I rounded the first bend. "Come back, you goddamn lying cannibal!" By the second branching, I was too far into the darkness for him to follow. I hurtled on, pausing only at a glimpse of purple. I extended my hand to waken it with my scent. There was little chance Cromlech would have found his way, even with Hazelton's device, but it was better not to risk it. I let go of the tracking device, heard it plop into the digestive pad as the petals closed with a feathery rustle. I wound in more and more ribbon as the echoes of desperate cries skipped from pathway to pathway behind me until they blended among the far-off roars and growls. I felt sorry for them all, even Cromlech, but decorum demands death for knowing the ending of the king, and my world hung in the balance. I could not let my father's weakness show in me. The sun was rising when I reached the outermost ring, barely in time to return to my throne. I waded through the slanted bars of light driven into the leafy shadows and looked out at my waiting bearers and hoodsmen. A part of me longed to stay where I was, monarch of that diminished realm, freer than any of my line had ever been. But that is not the duty of the king. The struggle my father almost lost had passed to me. I understood now why my ancestors insisted the new king face the old, for in that meeting is the seal of strength. When the new king looks into the eyes of whence he came and where he will go, I understood what the late king, my father, had not. The old ways are best. "I see from your backs you've grown ever so much more comfortable. No, no, don't try to rise. You can't, I'm afraid. Now you can appreciate how easy it is for me to stare into the middle distance without moving or focusing on anything. Nothing to it when the wine is sweet with Torone. But I must go. While I sleep, your remains, like my hair and nail parings, will be spirited away by Titagi. Do you, too, imagine I endanger my world with your deaths? On the contrary, my journey into the place of turnings has confirmed my faith. I think your fathers of fathers will not send those ships you threatened. If they are, as you say, such great rulers, then they too must understand decorum and why I must do as I do to serve my children's needs. Surely, like the poor man at the rich man's gate, they would sooner turn on their heels and go home than seem insensitive to the proprieties that maintain the tranquility of this poor and humble corner of creation. And if they would not, I have but to look in their direction. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.